please. Case number 07-1209 et al. Alaska Airlines, Inc. et al. Petitioners versus United States Department of Transportation. Mr. Goldberg for petitioners Alaska Airlines et al. Mr. Rosenthal for petitioners City of Los Angeles et al. Ms. Witham for the respondent and for the interveners, Mr. Goldberg for Alaska Airlines et al. And Mr. Rosenthal for City of Los Angeles et al.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Roy Goldberg, on behalf of the petitioners Terminal 1 and 3 Airlines at LAX, I'd like to reserve 1 minute of rebuttal for this portion of the case. Although the DOT correctly ruled on unjust discrimination in this case, the agency committed several errors in connection with the fair market value issue. These errors included failing to follow this court's ruling in ATA versus DOT, ignoring unrefuted evidence of monopoly power at the airport, refusing to apply the decision regarding FMV to Terminal 1 as well as Terminal 3, and ignoring the potential discrimination in the maintenance and operations, or M&O fees. Let me turn to the first issue first. Now, in ATA versus DOT, 1997 case of this court, the court clearly instructed the DOT to have a rational explanation if it was going to treat airfield fees and non-airfield fees differently with respect to the use of fair market value. The court stated that the DOT's explanation for the distinction drawn between airfield and non-airfield fees is internally inconsistent. DOT later did a rulemaking, but then it withdrew the rulemaking to address this problem. Meanwhile, in 1999, this court in LAX 2, our current case is LAX 3, 165 F3rd 972, affirmed the DOT ruling that it was unreasonable to use fair market value for landing fees at LAX. We come back to LAX 3 now, and the DOT decided that it would be okay on the non-airfield side, the terminal side, to use a fair market value in some circumstances.
Doesn't that make sense? Because terminals are more likely to have concessions, stores, restaurants, what have you, whereas airfields, you're not going to put a Starbucks on the airfield.
Well, it may make sense, Judge Kavanaugh. We believe that the DOT needed to put that explanation on the record. That clearly this court 11 years ago said you need to explain. And what we seek here on this issue is just a narrow remand to let the DOT at least have the opportunity to explain the inconsistency, which they didn't do so. We do see, as this court saw 11 years ago, that there was some difficulty in trying to separate too clearly non-airfield versus airfield. I mean, you still have some of the same issues, and we think there are strong issues, and this gets to the second point because of the monopoly power. Now, we presented... Sure.
I'm finding this case a little difficult to keep in focus because of the multiplicity of closely related issues, but am I correct in thinking that here, having decided that fair market value was the permissible standard, nothing in the result turned on that?
Well, it certainly turned for the purposes of the T1 carriers, which is my third point, because they are paying at fair market value at this point and did not get a refund, unlike the T3 carriers, because of the issue that the DOT refused to apply their finding of unreasonableness as to Terminal 3 as to Terminal 1. But, Your Honor, it's true that Terminal 3 carriers are not currently paying fair market value, but there's negotiations going on right now. We believe they're certainly standing. The airport still has the DOT ruling, as do other airports in this country.
But you say the T1 carriers are now paying.
They do pay based on fair market value because of the way the DOT dealt with that evidentiary, what we thought was an evidentiary issue.
I'm also, I share some Judge Ginsburg's inability to separate out all these different issues. But with respect to fair market value, DOT said, okay, but only as to aeronautical uses.
That's correct. Right?
So the concessions are not aeronautical uses.
That's correct.
Right?
So that was a dictum, correct?
That was a dictum? That was not a dictum.
No, that it was not dictum, and
right.
That's correct. And we like that part of we're glad that the DOT didn't go all the way where LAWA wants you to go, obviously. But we still think having any fair market value, aeronautical use or not, is error for two reasons. First of all, they needed to comply with ATA.
Let me ask on this. So if they're not going to do this in a way, this may be helpful to you. So just because I'm asking doesn't mean it's not. With respect to the airfield, your argument was there has to be an explanation for why there's a difference between the two. Judge Kavanaugh suggested one, as did opposing counsel, one possibility is concessions there's a market for. But what's the market for aeronautical, why is the market for aeronautical use of the terminal space any different than the market for airfields? I mean, if it has to be an aeronautical use, it seems to be another good argument that they have to explain why aeronautical use of a terminal is any different than aeronautical use of an airfield.
They should make give an explanation, which they didn't do. And the entire airport, because of the grant money, needs to be used as an airport. And an airfield, obviously, we maintain they can't go ahead and set up a speedway just because they want to make more revenue and get rid of one of the runways. And in the terminal side, our position
they can,
is...
They can do a lot in the terminals.
Well,
terminals are like shopping malls now.
Well, we don't agree, Your Honor, with all
the
respect.
Well, you walk through them, aren't they?
Well, there has to be a line drawn. We're here today to make sure that line gets drawn in a way that's reasonable. We're afraid that airports are drawing that line in an unreasonable way to the extent where airlines can't even use the space going up to the door, to the gate, but rather there's somebody sitting there when you're trying to walk to your plane having a McDonald's, and it's getting ridiculous. And we think the line has to be drawn, especially when you're talking about an airport that's a monopolist. And that's our concern also is that the...
Wait a minute. Are some airports monopolists and some not?
Certainly.
And why is this one a monopolist when there are four airports or something in the metropolitan?
Well, most of the airports are owned by the same entity, LAWA. For example, they own Van Nuys, Palmdale, Ontario, and this airport. So
what are they not
central
own?
Control. They don't own Long Beach. They don't own Orange County. But there was plenty of evidence in the record that suggested there were limitations with those airports. This is the McGlay testimony, the Dan Casper testimony.
Let me go back
sure.
A second. The city is objecting to this limitation to aeronautical uses.
That's correct.
Why isn't it your position that they have no basis for that objection because nothing turned on it in this case?
That's true. Nothing in this case turned on that. That's
right?
True. But they're concerned about the current negotiations
and
with
you're
us.
You're concerned about the future.
And we're concerned about the negotiations.
In fact, there's nothing turned on it here. It was a dictum.
Not in the case, but as far as what's going to happen, the DOT doesn't have a lot of these decisions, and the industry has to go by these decisions to know what positions can be taken. We went by ATA versus DOT.
Any other questions you'd like us to answer?
Well, these were questions that were decided. We do want you to decide the monopoly issue. We think that was the elephant in the room. The DOT had plenty of evidence, and that they said, well, it wasn't really an issue in this case, but it was, Your Honors, an issue in the case.
Is there another opportunity to present this argument? That this is another thing I wasn't clear on. They said that it wasn't in the order, so they didn't, and I appreciate you disagree with that, but is the implication of what they're saying is you'll have another chance to make that argument somewhere down the road, or you'll never have a chance to make that argument?
I don't see that implication at all. I don't think they're saying that. We made the argument. They decided not to. The DOT decided they didn't want to consider it. At the end of the opinion, they said, well, it really wasn't in the case, but we put in lots of evidence. It really wasn't refuted. But the ALJ made the finding that the airport's a monopoly, and the DOT said, well, it wasn't really in the instituting order, but the instituting order wasn't exclusive, and the instituting order had the global issue as to whether fair market value is reasonable, and monopoly is one component of whether fair market value.
If the statutory standard is a reasonable rate,
right?
And they're saying, for whatever reason or perhaps lack of reason, we're going to use fair market value, and you're at least implicitly contending that the determination of fair market value is different because they're a monopolist.
Correct. We think that.
Why is that?
Because the whole nature of fair market and monopoly is mutually exclusive.
Exactly. So if they're going to determine the fair market value, isn't it presumably with reference to not the monopoly maximizing value, but the competitive price?
That is not something the LAWA has ever said. They say they're a commercial operator, basically can do what they want like a landlord. The DOT has never said we're allowing this, but only if somebody is policing the monopoly aspect. Now, our concern, Judge Kavanaugh, is exactly what you said, that this is run amok and that airports are getting more and more aggressive in turning their buildings into shopping malls, basically, and that the airlines are getting squeezed and they can't compete with some of these concessions who have the ability, if they don't want to put a footwear store in the airport.
Because they can charge higher fees, right, to the concessions than they can to the airlines.
And the concessions.
Which is their complaint.
And the concessions, like Wolfgang Puck, he's at LAX. Well, if he can't be at LAX, he can go somewhere else. But the airlines don't have that option.
Wait a minute. No. He's somewhere else, but that's irrelevant. He wants to do business here, and he's either facing a monopoly price or he isn't.
But he can do business in Los Angeles without having to be at the LAX airport. The airlines can't.
This is true, but that is not relevant to the question of whether he's facing a monopoly price for this, right? All retailing is oligopolistic, an imperfect form of imperfect competition, right? Because every location is
more imperfect for the airlines.
Yes, fair point. It is. That's right, because for obvious reasons, but the concessionaires don't have the protection of a reasonable price standard, isn't that right?
The concessionaires don't have that reasonable standard.
Right. The airport may be able to extract from them the maximum, the monopoly profit maximizing price, right?
If it's considered for them a monopoly, the airport has more options.
But they are constrained with respect to you to charge only a reasonable price.
Only a reasonable price, that is correct.
On a square foot basis, is your rent less than Wolfgang Puck's?
I wouldn't know, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that.
For a second. I thought the argument was that with respect to the concessions, there's a monopoly on that with respect to that airport. There are other ways for Wolfgang Puck to make money.
Correct.
And so the cross elasticities here, he is likely to leave if the price of working at the airport is higher than the price working somewhere else. You do not have that luxury. You cannot say, well, we'll just not serve Los Angeles.
We do, and there was abundant evidence in the record, unrefuted, that is not our option.
Whether you call it monopoly or not, there's no doubt that the monopoly, the market power of the airline is considerably strong with respect to you than to the concessionaire, the airport, than with respect to the concessionaires.
Correct.
But isn't the way to police that through the reasonableness determination?
Well,
rather than a saying you can't use this methodology at all?
Yes.
Is there a reasonableness determination other than fair market value?
Unjust discrimination is...
I got that one. But other than that, I thought their point here is that I thought what the airport wants to do is make fair market value the definition of reasonableness.
Well,
some other constraint?
I don't know. They want to use, there is a cost-based constraint ultimately, but that gets into all issues as to how that's done. Reasonableness is the standard we want, and we think when you look at reasonableness.
Pause over that. When you say there's a cost-based constraint, is that cost is not going to include opportunity cost?
Well, they say it does include opportunity cost.
So,
we say it doesn't.
Well, I understand that, but if we were to accept this position, there wouldn't be a cost constraint other than because the cost is defined as opportunity cost. Now, there's some argument about surpluses of the...
If surpluses over time ultimately got to be, so it became the Taj Mahal of airports, you might have a remedy, but that's a remedy that's never been able to be pursued. I think reasonableness is fine, Judge Kavanaugh. We believe that when you look at reasonableness, you have to look at the fair market value issue. Is it reasonable? And when you look at fair market value, you've got to look at monopoly power.
That's my point, and I think Judge Garland's is, if you determine that fair market value is the appropriate methodology, is there, in applying that methodology, a separate reasonableness cap, want of a better word, on that, how they can apply it?
Well, sure. Well, we believe
I think you would say yes.
Yes. We believe it shouldn't be applied, but if it's going to be applied, we want it limited to aeronautical use. We want objective rather than having the LAWA staff decide what the fair market value is. Yeah, we totally agree with that.
But LAWA doesn't have... Their concept would not add any additional reasonableness test on top of what they've done.
They would not add that test. Let me just say we think that this is an important issue also as to T1. This was a case, it's not like, with all due respect, LAX1, where you had carriers who didn't file a timely complaint. Our complaint was filed timely in the middle of the hearing, not outside of the hearing. Counsel for LAWA says, well, we have a mistake in the numbers. They propose we deal with it within the hearing. We ask the judge for guidance. He says, yes, we'll deal with it in the hearing. We deal with it in the hearing. The ALJ finds the FMV is unreasonable as to both terminals. And then out of the blue, when it's too late for us to file a new complaint, the DOT says, well, you needed to file a new complaint. We think that that was arbitrary and capricious. And one of the remedies we seek here is to have that aspect of the case remanded.
I think the question is not, at least the initial question is not that. It's whether, not whether it's arbitrary and capricious. The initial question is whether the statutory requirement is jurisdictional. Well, 60-day report.
We don't believe that. Let me address that first. Like the PMD case we cite, which was the appeal time, where the ALJ said you can do it 30 days after my written, and it was actually 30 days after the oral. That was also jurisdictional, but that was not a problem for the court, this court, to decide that because they relied on the ALJ's guidance, that they did not thereby waive their appeal time. So even that's PMD. I have a cite for Your Honor.
Is it in your brief?
Yes.
PMD Produce 234 F3rd 48. The party there relied on the ALJ's statement that they had 30 days from his written ruling to file an appeal, and they ended up being 30 days from his bench ruling, and therefore the appeal was untimely filed for that reason. And the court should be under PMD Produce, but it's under our reply brief, Your Honor. Yeah, the second brief. And that was also technically a jurisdictional issue. But that was not a problem because it goes into this unique circumstances doctrine that is referenced in that case, Your Honor. And we believe clearly this is that type of situation. I mean, there are just so many facts as to why what we did was reasonable. We asked for the guidance of the ALJ. We used the proposal from LAWA. It was LAWA's mistake.
Did you file once it was clear it was going to apply? Was a brief filed before the ALJ? Was it amendment to the previous briefs or anything like that?
Well, we filed a joint complaint that had to have all the testimony. We did file our case brief to the ALJ, which of course dealt with issues as to both terminals, and we filed a brief to the department
The brief to the ALJ, that was after it was decided that it would apply to
T1? Yes.
And was that filing within 6 months?
Yes, that was within yes, that would have been within the 60 days. That would have been within the 60 days. Yes, that would have been within the 60 days.
So is there an argument then that you did file a complaint with the secretary? I take it the ALJ works for the secretary, is that right?
That's right. He is their delegate. That's right.
So isn't there an argument that you did actually meet the written?
We believe.
The text of the statute that you filed a written complaint with the secretary, in this case, secretary's delegate, namely the ALJ.
We believe, yes, we do, Your Honor. We believe that would have survived with the statute, assuming the statute on its face applies, which we don't think required us in this circumstance, so that we think the statute 47129A1B really talks about a complaint being filed for fees. We filed the complaint within the 60 days. The only thing is that during the case, the evidence changed somewhat, and we reacted to that change in the evidence. We also put in a stipulation with counsel for LAWA that it was the only stipulation at all to specifically deal with this issue, and it was that's JA 822 to 824, and this in the record, and this stipulation basically took all the new numbers and applied FMV then to T1 and to T3. The certificate of service showed it was served on DOT. Again, the entire purpose of the stipulation was just to deal with the change in the evidence. So that was something also in writing, Your Honor, that was put in, signed by parties, both parties.
In the evidence, there was a new order issued, wasn't there?
I'm not aware of a new order.
So what was the proceeding in which the evidence was newly or was changed?
We were the fourth day into the hearing. It was a Thursday of the week, and counsel, who's here today for LAWA, says, I have an announcement. We found a change, and the good news is actually they said, your rate's going lower, because even though it's higher than it was when the initial case was filed, because we're using fair market and value, not the other method, it's actually going to be lower. Because if we use the original method, it would be dirt lower. We couldn't do that. So actually, our fees had gone down. And then we worked out a stipulation with the other side as to how to address this new evidence, and the ALJ accepted that stipulation.
Okay, but no, so, I mean, it was just an oral representation that your rent would go down? That was all you got?
No, after that, they went ahead and put out a letter that was done, and we made that letter part of the record.
The final decision. In other words, if you did have to file a separate complaint, it would have been 60 days from that letter.
It's written notice. That's right. I think they actually went back to the BOAC, the board, and I'm sure they did something in that regard as well. But the 60 days would have started from that written notice, unless
somebody
the transcript,
file,
perhaps.
Somebody did file a subsequent writing, isn't that right?
The foreign carriers did, but that was different because they weren't covered under the original tariff, because when the cases were filed, they still were leaseholders, and their leases didn't expire till March 31st. So that was a very different situation here. Our tariff never changed. The tariff allowed the airport to use the higher of fair market value or fully allocated costs. They didn't have to change the tariff. They just decided, well, now that fully allocated costs has gone down, we're going to go to fair market value. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I can fully sympathize with you in trying to keep all these arguments separate. When I come up again, I will try to provide you with my defense of the fair market value, because there are four pages in the Federal Register which explain why FMV makes sense in terminals, but I can't deal with that here. Today, right now, my arguments have to deal with the reasons why we believe there were errors in the decision by DOT. By and large, we agree with the DOT decision, but the largest error we find in the DOT's decision is their ruling, which we find virtually inexplicable, as to why it was unjustly discriminatory for us to impose rentable on T1 and T3, but yet we are accused of being discriminatory because we could not impose rentable on the long-term carriers.
Why do you say inexplicable? It seems very explicable that huge fees were being imposed on T1 and T3 that were not being imposed on T2, T4 through 8.
Well,
that's on its face, that's true, correct?
Yes.
That's discrimination. The question, I suppose, is whether it's unjust discrimination.
Well, it's a difference, Your Honor. But if I can give our three arguments,
sure.
I mean, number one, under this court's decision in Newark, where there is a discrimination claim, the burden is on the air carriers to explain, to prove that the difference is unjust. That was a holding by DOT. It was upheld by this court, and there's no dispute that inexplicably, DOT in this case imposed the burden on us to explain why this difference was just. I mean, it is a complete turning of the burden of proof, and there's not even an acknowledgement in the decision that they changed their mind from the Newark case. So, number one, as a pure legal matter, you don't even have to get to the merits. There was a shift in the burden of proof.
In your theory, could an airport that it has long-term contracts and imposes different fees on those airlines with the long-term contracts, could that ever be considered unjust discrimination when different fees were imposed on other airlines? Could it ever be unjust discrimination?
I think there might be circumstances.
Such as?
Well, if we were today offering two different long-term contracts, one to one set of airlines and one to another set of airlines, and
I agree with you on that hypo, but I'm positing that some airlines are already locked into long-term contracts. Could it ever be unjust discrimination to keep those and charge different fees?
If both sets of rates are reasonable, which is what we posit here, no one disputes that the DOT upheld the 207 rates as reasonable, the 2007 rates as reasonable. No one has ever disputed that the old rates that we imposed were reasonable at the time. I think it would be very hard for anyone.
Close to a per se rule that it's okay, and I know everyone gets frightened when they hear the term per se, but it's close to a per se rule that the airports can do this when they have long-term contracts locking in some of the
airlines. And indeed, there's a string of precedents which we've cited in which other circuits and DOT have held that where there is any real difference in timing, where you're dealing with short-term versus long-term, that's what Penobscot holds, that's what Wilson holds, that's what City of Reading holds. These are DOT cases interpreting this precise provision.
Won't that have a huge competitive effect on the airlines that are not locked into the long-term contracts?
Well, the problem is it all equals out over a long haul.
Long haul.
But the alternative is it can work to their advantage, it could be worked to their disadvantage. I mean, ordinarily, I think the airlines think of things as always going up, but it may not necessarily be the case. We're in a much different economic situation today in 2008 than we were even in 2007. Maybe the fact that people are locked into deals may be a disadvantage because they lock themselves into very high rentals made during a period in which rental rates were high. But it's not just, I don't think we should just limit ourselves, Your Honors, to the rates involved here. Because remember what actually happened in the early 1980s. These airlines actually built terminals, which we needed desperately in order to service the Olympics. They committed themselves to build the terminals. They committed themselves to bonds. They committed to providing an income stream to operate the airport. We got very valuable economic benefits from that deal. No one disputes that these were arm-length transactions. At this point in 2007, we're dealing with utterly different circumstances. The statute talks about reasonable classifications. And I think our core point here is if it is reasonable to put on one side of the ledger transactions entered into in 1983 in which people are building their own terminals, in which they're financing their own bonds, in which you have an economic conditions. It was a residual airport. And on this side, people who come in 2007 who make no commitment to the airport. Mr. Goldberg's air carriers under the tariff could decide tomorrow morning to leave the airport. There's no financial commitment. There's no stream of revenue we're guaranteed. If this isn't a reasonable classification.
It's like Newark and Continental, you're saying?
Yes, it is precisely like Newark and Continental. Continental built its own terminal, and in that case, the airlines did not come forward and explain, even give a rationale for what constitutes unjust discrimination. Here, all of a sudden, the burden has been placed on us.
Mr. Russell, if I recall correctly and understood correctly at the time, DOT said there wasn't a correlation, or at least not a complete correlation, between the rent disparity and the classification that you've just suggested. The old carriers put up the capital and so on.
What they said is that we did not, that they imposed the burden on us, and they said we have to explain the correlation between the disparity. And our position, of course, is that if there's anyone who has the burden, they do. But I will be frank, Your Honor. The two circumstances, 1983 with all the circumstances that took place there in 2007, I'm not saying it's a per se rule, but I think it would be extraordinarily difficult. I think it would take a Nobel Prize winner to try to correct for all of the different factors and come up with a way to correlate those two.
Here's the question. Are all of the carriers in the T2 and 4 to 8 group who are not subject to the current change in methodology, are they all carriers who contributed capital to the construction of the terminals?
No, they did, Your Honor.
All of them?
All of them.
And none of the T1, T3 carriers?
None of them.
So what did the DOT mean, if anything, by saying the correlation wasn't perfect?
I don't understand.
Can you even object to the burden if the point is just factually incorrect?
Well, it's factually incorrect, and I think it's what you're stating is another way of maybe we're stating it different ways. The circumstances, that's one difference, but I mean, to me, the larger difference is the whole circumstance of 1983 and the whole economic regime that existed there, which included the building your own terminals.
So your representation to the DOT, it's in the record, right, is that all of the low-rent, long-term leases reflect capital contributions, and none of the currently disputed lease rates do.
I think that is the representation we made. I mean, these are tariffed air carriers. T1 and T3 are tariffed carriers who come in, use our facility, and the others essentially guaranteed bonds with their full faith and credit. And that deals with a component. There was also a M&O component to deal with our cost factors, which were also put into the formula. But you're absolutely right. That is a fundamental aspect of the difference between the two.
You know, all these carriers had the opportunity in the 80s to enter into a long-term contract with you?
I don't know. Well, some of the carriers didn't exist. Many of them didn't exist. Two of them, according to what the record shows, is that two of them entered into leases, but they entered into short-term leases, five-year leases.
I ask a question. It seems to me you were making a broader argument than the one you just exchanged with Judge Ginsburg. That is, the capital contributions in the 80s is an example of why there's a difference between treatment of long-term and short-term. But there's always a difference, and people make bets about whether to make long-term and short-term. It's certainly the case that airlines that bet at one point that the price of jet fuel would be high and hedged that way are going to be at a competitive disadvantage today, although 6 months ago was the opposite with respect to somebody who is now buying at a considerably lower price. And that's just a decision about whether you enter into long or short term, and that if we don't respect that difference, there'll never be a reason for entering into long term because you'll never be able to change.
I think a very accurate statement of exactly the way we presented it below. I mean, we made the broad argument of which Judge Ginsburg is one element of.
So this argument is one that could resolve this case, but you are actually making a broader argument.
It was a whole list of the categories of which the capital contribution is only one. Short-term leases. I'm not sure it's in the record, but I don't see any reason why we would have turned down any airline that wanted to build a terminal.
And you did present a question, though, which is that this would disadvantage new airlines, this program, and they would never have had the opportunity, new carriers, and they would not have had the opportunity to get in on the long-term deal.
They wouldn't.
This would permanently, or at least in the very long term, disadvantage any new entrant.
Just as was case in other cases, an FBO wasn't in existence at the time or wasn't in the marketplace, wouldn't have had that advantage, hadn't decided to service Los Angeles.
Is there an element of discrimination or unreasonableness in the fact that new entrants are going to be disadvantaged by not having the benefit of the long-term contracts?
I don't know whether that would be. It's certainly a difference, but I don't think it is unjust discrimination that someone hasn't come on the scene yet and just isn't available to enter into a deal. Otherwise, it is exactly what you described. A new person comes onto the scene and they could then cherry pick whatever deals happen to be out there, and they say, look, we're disadvantaged because A got this deal, B got this deal, C got this deal, so we want the advantage of everybody's various deals. Otherwise, airports would be unable to enter into long-term arrangements with particular people, because if the deal turned out to be better, then we would be ratcheted to that deal. Of course, if it's worse, then we could never get the advantage of that deal. It's long-term deals by their nature are gambles.
Some of the airlines enter into bad long-term deals that'll help new entrants.
That's exactly that may well be the case given the economics here, where there's been a downturn in the economy, where there may be space available. We may be required to give deals which are better than the long-term deals to get people to occupy space which we have. I mean, it's the luck of the draw, as we would contend. But I don't want to lose the fact that we also have a precedential issue. DOT has repeatedly said that these sorts of distinctions, far narrower distinctions, do not constitute unjust discrimination. That's what Penobscot, Wilson, what the decisions of this court and a whole raft of FERC cases say. You can't compare You can't compare somebody who's coming in on the spot market today with someone who has entered into a long-term supply contract on the other hand. That's not unjust discrimination, as long as in the current situation, everyone has a fair opportunity to enter into the same deal. But it's not an unusual circumstance. Can I briefly reach the other two issues in our case? But it will not take long to deal with them. The second issue which we raise is the calculation of the FMV. Your Honor is correct that the issue of non-aeronautical use is not in this case because we, in fact, when we calculated T3, used other aeronautical uses. We used what was negotiated between the airlines at the other terminals, and we adopted the lowest number, the $17.50. And therefore, what we would ask essentially is to indicate that the issue is dicta at the DOT level, that it's not reviewed here, and it's open to discussion in some later case. But there is one issue which does affect us, and it's the reason for the reversal. And it's the claim that somehow it is not an objective measure of FMV that our calculation was done internally as opposed to by a third-party appraiser. And
your theory there has to be that it wouldn't change the result if an independent appraiser did it.
It wouldn't have changed the result, and indeed.
So what's the harm from having it if it wouldn't change the result?
Because they reversed it. I mean, they disallowed our $17.50. I mean, if there's no difference.
Well, if you go out and get an independent appraisal and it comes in at $17.50, you're back where you started.
Your argument is it wouldn't be any better because we're doing it by the books, so you'll get the same appraisal from an independent appraiser. If that's true, you have nothing to fear.
Well, but under the Administrative Procedure Act, they have to give a reason why we are required to go through that process,
The reason why is they suspect that it's not going to be an independent appraisal when it's done in-house.
And
therefore, the numbers will be somewhat different and disadvantage the airlines.
But their real protection is the requirement that there be an objective process. And there's no dispute.
Isn't that up to the agency to police how they're going to interpret that and require that?
We would contend that there actually is a long stint.
I think it's unreasonable to interpret the word objective as meaning outside of you. How can that be an unreasonable interpretation of the word objective? It's not the one you want, but how can having a third party be an unreasonable interpretation of the word objective?
Our position is simply that there's no explanation as to why they required an outside appraiser. It's simply an ipsy dixit in the rationale, and the rationale you provided isn't even in the decision. Let me go to the third point, and that is essentially their claim that the MNO fees for 2006 were not based upon a written lease, and that's essentially a matter of California law. These are holdover tenants under California law. Both sides are bound by the last entered written lease between the parties. The only difference is the term. And DOT said there's no written agreement here. The written agreement to which both sides are bound is...
Isn't the agency entitled to have a uniform definition of written agreement that applies from state to state without regard to the vagaries of each state's law?
They are entitled to, and
isn't that what they've done?
Except for the fact that the definition they provided fully, their claim was that there was no agreement which contained the terms of the relationship, the rate, and everything. There was, in fact. So under their uniform standard, we still qualify. The only aspect we didn't qualify on is the term, but even DOT would probably concede a written agreement which was month to month would qualify. Otherwise, there was a written agreement. Are there further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Honors. May it please the court. First of all, I'd like to direct your attention to Joint Appendix 815, and this regards Mr. Rosenthal's statement regarding the capital costs. Specifically, Patricia Tubert, who was the witness for the airport, said that LAWA has never based the terminal rent on alleged investments by carriers and has never sought to justify the amount of the new terminal charges by reference to the amount of the investment the carriers and other terminals may have made in their terminals. So, in fact, all that we were presented with was essentially a per se justification that there was a 40-year lease, and that was the only difference between the two.
How's it different from Newark?
Different from Newark because in Newark, the first of all, the Continental had invested about $730 million in their facility. They were not subject to the GTC or FIS fee.
And the airlines here invested in the facilities that are subject to the long-term contracts?
Yes, but that was not part of the record at the time that we made this decision. What we saw was that you had comparable terminal rates that were changed. All of the carriers in this case were subject to the usable area methodology, and then there was the change so that the carriers in Terminal 1 and Terminal 3 were now subject to the larger rentable area methodology, whereas the carriers with the 40-year leases were not. And the only reason given by the airport at the time was because of the 40-year lease.
And why isn't that a good reason? We'd love to do it for everyone, but we can't.
Well,
but
first of all, it would be
as it's reasonable.
First of all, it would be a per se rule, and this court said specifically, Judge Brown in Newark said
But go ahead.
It would be a per se rule. And the other reason is that if you look at the policy statement, I believe it's section 4.1, where we talk about the fact that you can have, 3.1.1, you can have differences based upon signatories and non-signatories, but it has to be based on some kind of a reasonable classification. In other words, there has to be, as we've said, there may be cost justifications. For example, at Newark, the tenants tended to didn't necessarily come every single day. There were higher administrative costs, and there were specific reasons as to why there were higher costs and reasonable classification.
Where the airport just wants to enter into a long-term contract in order to have the security of knowing what its income flow is. That's the reason. And one airline is willing to do that, one isn't. That whenever the rates go down or whenever the rates go up, they can't go up at all. That they can't change it as long as there's that long-term contract is there.
Yes.
That's your position. So that means there won't be any long-term contracts, right?
No, not, and in fact, in this particular case, particularly the Terminal 1 airlines had been tenants for as long as the 40-year tenants. The only difference was they had 5-year leases. So
they didn't, for whatever reason, enter into a long-term lease. But so they have to enter into what the airlines ought to do is enter into 1-year leases and nothing more, and just keep renewing them. That's your position, that they should enter into very short-term leases so that they can accommodate changes because they can't get any benefit from a long-term lease.
No, that's not our position. Our position is that the airport can and the airlines can do whatever they want. And in the particular circumstances here, given the 1984 Olympics,
it'd be nuts for an airport to enter into a long-term agreement under your theory.
Well, in fact, the policy of the department now is to encourage shorter-term leases. And in fact, very similar.
Okay, well, that's not the rationale here.
I understand.
And what's the reason for the policy?
The shorter-term leases?
Yeah, yeah.
Why? To encourage flexibility.
But that also, so you don't see any economic benefit in long-term arrangements?
Certainly there are economic benefits. There can be various intangible benefits. As you say, there is a long-term income stream, and there is significant capital expenditures that are often made by the airlines that have long-term leases. And in fact, that can be the case. That was the case at Newark. The difference was here, as I pointed out to Ms. Tubert's testimony, that was not the basis of their justification. When we said, okay, where's the justification as to why the different classifications and why the different fee structures, they came back and they said, 40-year lease. That is the only justification. And to us, that represented a per se rule, and we said, no, there has to be something more. In addition, there were a number of reasons. The carriers in the Terminal 1 and 3 carriers didn't have the opportunity to sign long-term leases. The Terminal 1 and 3 carriers wanted new leases. They were competitively disadvantaged by not having the same terms as or having this change in terms and not being consistent with what the prior terms were.
I mean, the fact that there's a new methodology can't be enough, right?
Well, it wasn't just the new methodology. It was a significant...
I think the first rationale given in your brief was that this was a new methodology as
yes.
opposed to just different fees, which struck me as a very hollow...
Well, it was a new methodology that resulted in significantly increased fees. As we said, there was approximately...
And that's how you were distinguishing Newark, I think, which
yes.
is pretty thin.
No, it wasn't just the new methodology. There were really Newark and... In Newark, there was Continental and the Terminal B carriers, and there was really wholesale distinctions between them. In addition to the fact, remember, we didn't have as much evidence, as much information as to what the differences were in Newark as we have here. In Newark, we knew that there was the $730 million that Newark had put in that the airport told us. They told us that there wasn't a GTC or FIS fee, that there were that the airport was not responsible for any maintenance and operations expenses, versus in Terminal B, they were responsible for all of those. The airport in Newark had built the facility. The airport had was paying the GTC and FIS fees. They were responsible for all the maintenance and operations costs. So that's why those were very different, whereas here, everybody was paying under the usable fee methodology until the airport came along and said, no, we're going to impose the rentable air methodology on you, even though you've been carriers for just as long as these 40-year tenants, even though you pay the same type of M&O fees. Now, remember, a lot of these M&O fees related to roadway access costs, security costs, and general administrative costs that weren't exclusively tied to a particular terminal. They were very broad general costs, so by imposing this new methodology, it was unjustly discriminatory and put the T1 and T3 carriers at a competitive disadvantage. If there are no more questions on that, I'd like to turn to the fair market value for Terminal 3. The department reasonably determined that the fair market value for Terminal 3 had to be based on other potential aeronautical uses and that the airport's in-house...
What does that mean?
Meaning you had to compare, if you had a terminal space that was used for aeronautical purposes,
yeah.
such as gates, ticket counters, and then you were determining a fair market value, you had to look at other areas that were used for aeronautical purposes. You could not look to concession space,
right.
non-aeronautical
space. So what
space.
I'm having difficulty understanding is how you get to a fair market value for something that the airport has monopoly power over without evaluating the monopoly power question. I understand how you can do concessions because there may be market power, but there is no monopoly. But what is the answer with respect to aeronautical space?
Well, the department did not make a determination on monopoly power.
So how can it say use fair market value without knowing whether there's a fair market? That's really my question.
Well, I believe that there is a fair market because you have other terminal space that can be used. The issue that we had was that you had to have somebody who was a neutral
You're comparing,
appraiser.
I take it what you're comparing is how much either in other terminals or in other airports are being charged to airlines for using, say, the boarding area. Is that right?
Yes.
And how can you determine whether the amount that is charged to those other airlines is fair market or not without knowing the market power of the airport?
Well, I think that what you can do is if you look at, for example, if you have other agreements between the airport and airlines determining what the fair market value is, then that by definition
What does this mean to say what the fair market value is? Imagine you have a complete and total monopolist, okay? The only company in the business, and it has charged a certain amount to one airline and a certain amount to another airline, And then that monopolist says, well, that's the market price. That's the fair market price. That's how much I charged before. And they agreed. Amazing. They agreed. And therefore, that's the fair market value here. Now, how do you know that's not what you're dealing with here without analyzing the monopoly question?
Well, the department, there was evidence in the record that, in fact, there are other airports that are available.
Well, now you're addressing the merits. And my understanding is that the ALJ said there was a monopoly, and DOT said we're not going to address that at all. Am I right about that?
The ALJ said there was a monopoly, but in fact, there wasn't sufficient evidence in the record for him to make that determination.
Well, that's not, let me be clear. That's not what DOT said. DOT didn't say there wasn't enough evidence in the record. They said, because of the way the initial order was and everything, that we're not going to consider that question, right?
Well, what we did say was that we said that the airport did not have fair notice, that that would be one of the issues that we would determine, because what we specifically told the ALJ not to look at the monopoly power. So in fact,
wait, you said not to look.
We did not include it in his.
Well, you did not that. Now
no,
you sat here in the last argument about Rule 11, which I, as you could tell, I had some difficulty with, but. Just to be clear, they did not say don't look at monopoly power. They just didn't mention
it. It was not included within the issues that he was supposed to address.
Yeah, but I don't understand how, if you say the issue to be addressed is fair market value, why is it not a necessary element of fair market value that there be a market? That's what I don't understand, that there be a fair market and not one controlled by a monopolist. How can that not be an issue?
Given the fact that the final decision did not reach that issue, I'm just unable to make it.
And I take it that it can never be reached now. That's right. That is that they'll never have an opportunity to say that these comparables that are going to be used or that have been used are based on market power rather than the operation of a normally competitive market.
Well, I think that if you have a neutral appraiser, that's your opportunity to demonstrate that there is a what the fair market is.
Won't there be, I discussed this with your colleague, but won't there be some kind of reasonableness assessment of how the methodology is applied to me? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, there is. I mean, that's the department's job is to make a reasonable determination and determine what is reasonable.
It's not that it's completely up to the airport now to determine what the fair market value is.
Absolutely, and presumably a neutral appraiser would look at and consider some of the factors that we found wrong with what the airport had done.
But can the appraiser say this price that was offered, you know, that American Airlines is currently paying is not fair market value because the airport is a monopolist? Can they do that consistent with this opinion?
Appraiser would know how to address
right.
a monopoly question,
yes,
quite honestly.
Exactly. So they just have to look at comparables, but they can't evaluate whether the comparable is monopolist or not, correct?
I think
monopolist.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Turning to the written.
What can I ask on that?
Sure.
Why is it limited to aeronautical uses to begin with?
Well, because
that's really defeats the whole rationale for the thing. The idea I thought was opportunity costs. Well, the opportunity costs are primarily with the non-aeronautical uses, correct?
That's correct.
So the rationale for going to fair market value that is used to justify the methodology, then when it's adopted, it undercuts the very rationale that it was adopted for.
Well, Your Honor, the department does not look to non-aeronautical uses. We don't control what the market is for non-aeronautical uses.
No, but it just makes no sense.
Well, it could very well be that the fair market value, in fact, is higher than what concessionaires would pay. I mean,
really?
I think the assumption is that it would be lower, but I don't know that is necessarily the case. It could be just the other case.
What would you use it for? We're talking about opportunity costs, so what's the alternative use? If it's not a concessionaire, what's the alternative use? You said that the fair market value would be higher than what concessionaires would pay.
I said potentially, yes.
What comparable could make you conclude that?
Well, for example, if there's a greater need for gate space at a particular airport, and the airport said, "Listen, we've got to get rid of this food court because we really do have a demand for space. So let's take out the food court and let's put a
Market determination. That's a determination that things are too crowded here. Where's the price of this other than what the airlines are willing to offer for gate space?
I don't believe I have an answer for that, Your Honor. Like I said, we did not really focus on monopoly power issue. So I think the rationale that we provided, there's also some discussion of monopoly power that I would ask the court to take judicial notice of. I believe it was in the ATA case. So to the extent that I've not answered your questions, I direct your attention there. With regard to the written agreement, the department reasonably determined that, in fact, with regard to the Terminal 1 and 3 carriers, there was no written agreement. With regard to the foreign air carriers, who were still under the terms of their five-year agreements, they were under a written agreement, and we said that they did not have standing, essentially, to make their arguments.
What about the T1s who say that the ALJ told them that it was all right to do it this way?
Well, Your Honor, we looked at it as a jurisdictional matter. Under the statute, it is very clear
Why do you say it's jurisdictional? Our opinion, the opinion of Judge Brown you were talking about, particularly talks about the possibility that there might be, I think that's what I'm looking at. Oh, I'm sorry. It's the City of Los Angeles 1, which is Judge Ginsburg, addresses the question of whether the Secretary misled the complainants, which suggests at least the possibility of an equitable tolling.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that was a different case because at the time that case was going on, the statute had just been enacted, and in fact, certain of the carriers filed their complaint within 60 days, but the department had not yet issued its policy guidance and procedures as to how the case would proceed. So the department said, "I'm sorry, we're going to toll these, and we're going to wait."
If it's jurisdictional, they can't toll. Isn't that your point? I mean, if you could toll here, you would have.
Had the follow-on carriers filed within that first 60 days and been included within that first group, then they would have met the requirement. The problem was that when the department issued it, started the case, these follow-on carriers had not filed anything within the initial 60-day time period.
Well, they did file a brief, apparently, with the ALJ. Is that right?
The carriers here?
Yes, within 60 days of the new determination. And they filed a stipulation, whatever else.
That's right, but they didn't file a complaint with us. And in fact, there was the LAX-4 case where the foreign air carriers, they recognized that it was jurisdictional, and they filed a separate complaint.
When you say with us, the ALJ is a delegatee of the Secretary, isn't that right?
Yes, the ALJ is, but the Secretary determines the scope of the proceeding, and also by not presenting it to the Secretary, the Secretary could not make the initial determination whether it was a significant dispute, and that is one of the requirements of the statute that the Secretary is supposed to do. So the ALJ took it upon himself to make the determination that it was a significant dispute and could be included.
It's the same dispute as T3 has, isn't it?
Yes, and there may have been another way that we could have dealt with it had the complaint been presented to us.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Goldberg, in this capacity, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing the unjust discrimination issue, I'd like to direct the court to JA 416 to 421, testimony of a senior executive from Southwest Airlines who testified in 1982 they were not offered. They were at the airport. They were not offered the 40-year lease. And keep in mind, Your Honors, Southwest and my other clients are predominantly low-cost carriers. It's kind of like the MCI ATA, AT&T days. I mean, there's competition. There was and there is. And so it wasn't necessarily even then a level playing field, but they've been at the airport. U.S. Airways, another client, has also been at the airport all this time, and there's no evidence they were offered that. Let me go on to why Newark is not this case. For one thing, When we did our complaint, we had 2,800 pages of evidence. Newark had 65 pages. The prima facie case was not made in this case. It was made in this case because we showed we were using similar use of the same types of facilities and that there was a gross disparity. The key fact in this case...
Is there a gross disparity in Newark?
I don't believe there was anywhere near where it was here with the approaching $1 billion over 19 years. We're up to 19 years of discrimination, approaching $1 billion over those years. So every case is different. But the facts here were magnitude and duration were huge. Other circumstances I could certainly envision where you have changes in leases and a couple years here or there and maybe 15% here or there. But here the difference was huge when you're looking at something like $171 a square foot for a low-cost carrier and $14 a square foot for a legacy that they compete with. There is also clear evidence in this record of competitive disadvantage. For example, Pete McGlade of Southwest testified that they have 17 routes out of 19 nonstop routes. They compete with United or one of the other legacy carriers, and that this was a real issue for them. That's JA 755. I'm not sure whether that was in Newark, where you had international versus continental, which had a lot of its domestic traffic there. Now, our economist testified. I'm sorry.
2 minutes have come and gone.
Okay.
So I think it's time.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I have 2 points I want to make. First of all, thank you. Ms. Witham mentioned the testimony by Ms. Tubert. I think it may have been misinterpreted. What Ms. Tubert said was that once they went on to the new system in the 1990s, they didn't base rents on alleged investments. We were not talking about the fact pattern here. Let me deal with the other issue, which is the monopoly power in FMV. This is an issue in which this proceeding and these proceedings are covered by regulations. By statute, DOT had to adopt a set of regulations which governed what is reasonable. Those regulations were adopted in 1996, and those regulations explicitly permit fair market value. There is a 4-page discussion in the Federal Register of this whole issue. It appears as an appendix to our brief at A35 through A39, where the use of fair market value is discussed. The monopoly issue did come up. It was dealt with and the answers that DOT provided were that basically these are publicly run airports. They don't act as monopolists. There's no history of retaining monopoly profits. There is a discussion here of the monopoly issue, which is imported into the regulation. Maybe the rationale was adequate, maybe it wasn't, but these are the regs under which we're operating.
So your position, unlike the position in the final decision, is that monopoly power can never be considered, not just that it wasn't in the initial order, but that it can never be considered because the agency has considered it for all time for all airlines?
Well, all I'm saying is that it can be considered, but then it has to be revisited as part of the rulemaking, the FMV issue, the right to use FMV. How can it be improper for the agency to approve a use of FMV when it is obeying its own regulations, which permit the use of FMV and terminals?
Because it's now being applied for the first time to parties who are objecting to what the meaning of FMV is under these circumstances. They're not saying that you can't apply FMV. They're saying, on this argument, they're saying that FMV has to be interpreted in terms of monopoly power. I don't understand why when a rate is applied to them, they can't question whether it's a fair market rate. That is your position, that they can't?
No, our position is that there never was any argument about the application of FMV. This case never disputed the actual way in which FMV was calculated. There was one dispute, which was an arithmetic error, which we made, which we concede, which was that the 1750 should be recalculated to take account of rentable usable. And yes, they have accused, they've asserted monopoly power, but they have never come back and said that the 1750 should be 1350 or 1250. And I don't see how the agency could even credit it if the regulation permits use
of
FMV.
That's not the argument at JA66 upon which the DOT rejects monopoly power. They don't reject it on the ground that this is already in the regulations. They reject it on the grounds that parties didn't have an opportunity to brief it. Accordingly, we will disregard.
Well, I understand that. I understand that that was the reason it was not why they didn't deal with the issue, because it wasn't in the instituting order. We didn't have notice that that was an issue in the case. But frankly, it wouldn't be surprising that it not be included, given the fact that the rationale was already dealt with in the regulation, and therefore why revisit an issue which the agency had dealt with as a procedural matter? The 60 days have run. If there was something wrong with here, I mean, there were challenges to the regulations. We challenged them. They never challenged that aspect of these regulations. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. All the cases submitted.